can't even think in terms of anything more than 200 years. As Americans, we can't. People in China and people over in the Orient, in the Near East, the Middle East, they think in terms of millennia. Where we think in terms of 200 years, they think in terms of 2,000 years. And where we think our family, we look at it, you know, we've been in America for 4 generations. One man I talked with said his family has been in Nazareth for 4 centuries. That just blows my mind. But that this took 1,600 years, and that there's this backbone all the way down through the backbone, all the way down through this coherent revelation. We noticed that Genesis chapters 1 through 11, we won't go into that this morning, except this is what we noticed last week. The primary cause is God. It contains these first 11 chapters, which we looked upon as introductory. The creation, the fall, the genealogy from Adam to Noah, the flood, the replenishing of the earth, the confusion of the languages, the dispersion of the nations. We didn't get to do much in the way of looking at the introduction, except we just didn't get much into it. And we won't, because it is introductory. It covers a space of time. There's not a lot of agreement on the amount of time that lapsed between the creation of man and the call of Abraham. Usher's chronology puts the creation of man at 4,000 B.C. And this is Usher's chronology. And Usher just took the literal listing of the son of so-and-so. Abraham was the son. He took it as the literal, immediate, first-generation son. But that's not always used like that. But taking it literally, he calculated that the introduction or the creation of man on earth was 4,000 B.C., which lends some meaning as to what we're all about today in all the froth and the excitement about what's happening today. Because if there were 4,000 years prior to Jesus, and then we've got how many years subsequent to his birth now? Nearly 2,000. Guess what the premillennial theory and all the froth about coming up with the year 2000, what is supposed to be happening at the 2000th year, the beginning of the millennium, which would be which millennium? There were 4 millenniums before Christ. There have been 2 since him, which makes how many? 6. And then, you know, theoretically, what would be the next millennium would be the 7th millennium. Does that have ring any bells as far as connections with any overall pattern? And the 6 days of creation, and then God rested on the 7th day, and that perhaps that's been overlaid on in terms of millennia, and that 4 millennia before Christ, 2 afterwards, and then the 7th millennium would be the rest, the eternal rest. So that's where all of that is coming into play. Just think of it. All right, now, interlaced with that and contemporary with the history of the Jewish people, what other nations are involved? What other nations are involved and that preceded the Hebrew nation? Which nations preceded the Hebrew nation as a culture? Which are the nations? The Egyptian dynasties and all go way back beyond the children of Israel being in Egypt, or even beyond Abraham. It extends back, way back. It's one of the oldest cultures in the world. Something else that is old, another civilization. Starts with a B. The Sumerian, yeah. The Akkadian, the Sumerian. Not Sumerian in the sense of, it's Sumerian, isn't it? That's what you were saying. It's not Samaritan, it's the Sumerians back over in Akkadia and Sumeria. Those date way back, present-day Iraq. That's what occupies the land there. Iraq and Iran and Kuwait, all that country over there near the Mesopotamian, in the Mesopotamian Valley. All of those cultures existed long before the Jewish culture. It was out of those cultures that God called Abraham. and established with him this strange covenant. And why he chose Abraham, I don't know. But it was in his plan, and this isn't all that clear, but you've got, starting on the left-hand side of there, down at the bottom of the page, you have the different nations and when they came into their prominence. We don't have records of where they came into existence immediately, or at least pinpointing their start, but where they came to be prominent. And you've got the Mesopotamians, you've got the Egyptian, you've got the Syria, Palestine, Anatolia, Crete, Persia, Greece, Italy. All of those came into existence, and they had their days of ascendancy and their days of decline. Other nations came over and took over. Especially, we're aware of this when it comes to Babylon and Persia and Greece and Rome. Those become very distinct in our thinking, because out of there we find things that happened that interacted with the Jewish people. Now, if you look on the back page, page 4, ancient texts relating to the Old Testament. Now, one of the reasons why the history of the Jewish people is so definitive, and why Bill Moyer would take it upon himself to create a whole series called what on television? Did you see the series by Bill Moyer? I didn't see it all, but he called it Genesis. And they went back into the book of Genesis and took the events in the book of Genesis, especially in the earlier part of it, as being representative not just of a small little group of people, but representative of the whole human struggle. And the stories that are related about those early beginnings of the human race, they, he says, are representative, and are so representative of the whole human race that they deserve intensive study. And they can give us some pointers. And so this record of the Jewish people is so central to human experience. And then it is so corroborated. You know, there are people who say all that was just, not the figment of somebody's imagination, but it's all just the story, epics, fables. That's not real. And yet, look at all of these texts on the back of this page 4 that corroborate. There are those things in the Egyptian literature that sound an awful lot like the God of the Hebrews. And Amenhotep was another one. There's a song. There's music, or there are songs, psalms of the Egyptian religions that they sound a lot like the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so there's that similarity in general terms. There's some other ones. There is the, well, Gilgamesh epic. You see down about midway on the first column, the Gilgamesh epic. It's an Akkadian, early second millennium B.C. Early second millennium B.C. puts it about 1900 B.C. Would you believe that Gilgamesh, the ruler of Uruk, experiences numerous adventures, including the meeting with this, I can't pronounce his name, Utnapishtim, the only survivor of a great deluge? They describe a flood. This Gilgamesh epic describes a flood. I mean, a huge universal flood. We'll notice in a moment, I'm not sure it can be said that it's in every culture, but in a vast amount of the cultures and the histories of the cultures, there's that astonishing duplication of a flood. Now, you know, that's got to be reckoned with. These are general affirmations or validations of the whole story of the Bible. When you've got something as pronounced as a almost a virtual total duplication of the story of a flood, it comes not just from the Bible, it comes from the Epic of Gilgamesh, it comes from here, and you just keep seeing this thing crop up. You can pretty well conclude, you know, that must really have happened. And then you've got records of the Ark on Mount Ararat. You've got all of them. Now these, you'll have to go back and read all these, and I haven't done that. I've checked with some of them. But then you've got another one, by the way, Hammurabi's Code. And it's listed here as Hammurabi's, which is the same man. Hammurabi's Code, Akkadian, about 18th century B.C. That's an estimate. But Hammurabi may very well have been contemporary with Abraham. There is an Amraphel who was a king in the time of Abraham, Amraphel. And it's been speculated that they're the same man, Hammurabi and Amraphel being the same man. But he wrote a code that is about not second to none, it's second to one. Hammurabi's code is second in its excellence to one. That is the code that Moses gave to the Jewish people on Mount Sinai. Of course, you're familiar with the Dead Sea Scrolls. And this gets down into more specific correlation. The Dead Sea Scrolls, what do they contain? They contain so many things. We had at our earliest date, our earliest manuscript of the Old Testament writings dated about 1000 A.D. About 1000 A.D. That's the earliest manuscript that we had. I mean by that, we had copies of copies, and the earliest one, all the ones before that, they were gone. They were destroyed. We had, though, manuscripts that dated back to about 1000 A.D., which meant that they were only about 900 years old for us. Whenever the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, those scrolls jumped 1,000 years. They jumped a whole millennium. And if you can imagine something sitting in a jar, something made out of animal skins and not of papyri, if you can imagine something like that sitting unnoticed in a jar for 1,000 years before our current one, and actually almost 2,000 years they've been sitting there unnoticed. And then who discovered them? A little shepherd boy. I just guessed either throwing rocks at a sheep or throwing rocks. And he heard something that sounded like a jar break. And he went up into that cave and looked in there, and not only is there one cave, but there are several caves, and he saw all these jars. And he looked in them, and he knew back then they kept manuscripts and things in jars, and then the dry climate allowed it to be preserved. He went in there and saw that thing, and I think he took one of them and sold it to one of the antique dealers over there for something like $10 or so. He didn't know what he had. Comes to find out, it was either Isaiah or one of the great writings of the Old Testament. And so you have this corroboration. There you have a corroboration of text, assuring us that there was not a lot of adulteration or confusion of the copying, because the texts that were found were so nearly identical to the text that text of a thousand years back was so nearly identical to the text that we have today that it virtually didn't justify translating. So the meticulous way in which they copied it makes us know that the records that we have of those times, if that represented the way they copied the records of those times, you can pretty well count on it. That's what they were doing. This Dead Sea Scrolls bore out what we did know about the scribes and the copyists of those days, that after they had copied a page, they would go back and count the letters, these scribes that gave their eyes and gave their lives. They would go back, these Jewish copyists would go back and count the very letters to make sure that there were the exact number of letters. And then they would throw away that pen and go get another pen and start doing it with another pen. And then there were occasions where they would come to something that was so hallowed that they would take off their garments and go take a bath and put on some more clothes. And the way they determined whether or not a book deserved to be in the canon, the Hebrew canon, do you know what they called it? They had a way of... They said, does it defile the hands? And they meant by that, not defile in the sense of being filthy. They meant by that, does it leave the hands radioactive? Does just the handling of that book leave you where you feel like you've been in touch with radioactivity? That's what they meant by defiling the hands. It was awesome the way they did that. But now that was a corroboration of text. So you've got general corroborations in the sense that there were different cultures telling about the flood and telling about the different events that took place in the Bible. And then you've got the corroboration with the text. And then all the way through these obelisks, all the way through these tablets, the chronicles, all of these other writings, you've got dating of people. And those dates of the people can be established and corroborated through other histories, and they name some of the kings of Israel. And they name the kings, and they tell what happened prior to the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem. And it gives the date. And so the historians are able then to piece all this together, and we come to find out that the Bible story is really true. It's there. Now, if you want to get a book and read it and have your socks blown off, if you've got an extra pair, put them on, because this will blow your socks off. Read the book, The Bible as History. The Bible as History by Werner Keller. W-E-R-N-E-R. Werner is a German. Keller, K-E-L-L-E-R. Werner Keller, The Bible as History. It's a big book, but I guarantee you, you won't put it down. It is fantastic. And what it does, it weaves all of this history together. But primarily, it's a record of the authenticity and the validation of the Bible as history. It's not just folklore, that it's actually the history. Okay, now, in this outside the Bible, there's a similar recurring theme, and we're going to study more about this later. There's a recurring theme that you find. Seven elements of universal awareness possessed by nations outside the biblical record. Which means that what God was doing with the Jewish people was not unique in the sense that no one else knew anything about it. There seems to have been a universal awareness that has come about because of this, not the coherent revelation, but the ambient revelation. Do you have any record of there being people with whom God had direct connections other than the Jewish people? Do we have any record that God revealed Himself to anybody other than the Jews? Name somebody. Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, what was his nationality? He was a Midianite. Yeah. Jethro, who else? Pardon? Melchizedek. Yes, he figures in greatly in our study. Melchizedek. There's another one that's not, he's kind of a shady character. Well, Nebuchadnezzar, now, one shadier than Nebuchadnezzar. Balaam. So you've got Balaam, Nebuchadnezzar, you've got Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, you've got Melchizedek, the city of Nineveh. Oh, when Jonah was sent to the city of Nineveh, but that was still through Jonah, but it was to those people. Okay, now we're going to get to that later, how that other nations were influenced by the Jewish nation. We'll hold that one because it has more to do with that. But I'm talking about that God had a revelation that He gave to the nations, and just in general. Now, look if you will, and we're going to then look at some verses in the Bible. This belief in the existence of God. There is a pervasive awareness that there is somebody above us. And people haven't always been clear as to who it is. But in every nation, there never has been found a nation of people that didn't worship something that they considered to be above themselves. Never. They have always. Now, much of it has been superstition, and some of it has been very heathen. The deterioration of that awareness is one thing, but the belief in the existence of God, it's there. The creation, that's also in so many revelations or so many cultures, the belief and the knowledge of the creation. Stories of the rebellion and fall, and the need of a sacrifice to atone for sin. That's one of the most visible ones, because virtually every culture has some way of offering blood and requiring blood. The religions of the ancients, the pantheism, way on back, and all those different nations, the heathen nations, they had sometimes the existence of a cultural practice where they sacrificed a human. But nevertheless, there was this need for the sacrifice to atone for sin. And then the stories of the great flood, the Epic of Gilgamesh being one of those. The sudden appearance of many languages. This is referred to in various writings, that all of a sudden there were these many languages. And if you want to find out, you know, something that you can really put your finger on, where in the world did all these languages come from? And what I want to know is, why don't they just all speak English? It would so be so much easier. Where in the world did they come from? Well, and then number 7, the acknowledgement of the need of some further revelation that will seal mankind into a blessed relationship with God. Now, I have the material. It's in a book called, if you want to read another book, is Eternity in Their Hearts. I'll bring the book next week. The framework we're using, and yet we're not getting into the detail, but half of his book lists nation after nation after nation, and their writings that reveal all 7 of these different attributes, and the degree to which these, the consciousness or awareness of these 7 attributes exists, the degree to which it exists, shows the degree to which they are nearer to the real God. The further away they get from God, the less likely you will find these attributes being a part of their religion. But there are some religions that have all of these in it. The names of the God, the name of the God is different, and we'll look at that perhaps. But there are some similarities in names. Delos, Theos, Zeus, all of these are virtually variations of the same word. Zeus, Z-E-U-S, one of the Greek or Roman gods. And then you've got those who are the Deos, and then you've got the Theos, and the D and the The, they're just, both of them are, what do they call them, the D and the T. The TH and the D are so similar that you're forced to say, you know, they were talking about the same God. Some of these gods, some of these nations have gods that are, the name is so like, is so near to Jehovah that it will scare you. And they've been worshiping this God for years, for hundreds and centuries and centuries. And they've been worshiping a God whose name was almost exactly like Jehovah, Yahweh. And so, I have all that material, but if you want to go, do it in detail, get the book Eternity in Their Hearts, and I forget the name of the man that wrote it. Don Richardson. That's it. Don Richardson. That's another book that you just absolutely, you'll read it and your mouth will just drop open as you see something. You're going to see that not only did God prepare the gospel for the whole world, God prepared the whole world for the gospel. And that it was not just one giant leap from where God was to where He wanted people to be. He gave this revelation of the Jews to the Jews, that served as a bridge. But then He also shed this ambient revelation to the nations that gave each person, you know, an awareness that that's right. Now, let's look at some verses that verify that. They're up here on the screen. Look at Romans 1, 18 through 23. We're just using these one or two or three lessons to kick us off into this backbone of the Bible. And I'm going to mention the backbone of the Bible real quickly. The backbone of the Bible, and we'll notice it next week in particular, the backbone of the Bible is missions. And it may be that you want to just call it one, mission. There is a very serious mission that is ours, and it didn't begin with Jesus of Nazareth. It began with Abraham. And we'll look at that more. But look here. In verses 18 through 23, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. Made it plain to whom? Just them. He's talking about the nations here, the Gentiles, the non-Jew. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. So you've got here a general ambient revelation in the sense that the creation itself forces people who are thinking. It forces us to be aware and to come to the conclusion, this couldn't have just happened, it had to have been created. There is not one single experience that anybody in here has had, or that anybody in the world has had, where they ever saw a watch just growing out of the ground, you know, Now, they may have found one that somebody lost, but you know what they whenever someone finds a watch in the mud, guess what they automatically think? Somebody lost their watch. I dare say anybody that can see through a ladder would never say, well, look at there. There's that watch going out of that mud. Never. Well, now that ought to tell us something. Unconsciously, it ought to tell us that we are geared to know that anything that is made has to have what? A maker. Anything that shows design has to have a designer. Okay, now look again. Turn to chapter 2. And not only do you find them being aware of the nature of God, or not the nature of God, but the presence of God. In chapter 2, he says, beginning in verse 12, beginning in verse 12, all who sin apart from the law will also perish apart from the law, and all who sin under the law will be judged by the law. For it is not those who hear the law who are righteous in God's sight, but it is those who obey the law who will be declared righteous. Indeed, when non-Jews, the word Gentile is used here, when non-Jews who do not have the law do by nature things required by the law. What do you mean by nature? They don't have the law, but they did by nature the things that the law required. Where did that come from? Well, now the law existed. Hear him talking about this coherent light. It existed. But the non-Jew didn't have that law. But they were found to be doing by nature the things that were contained in the law. He says they have become a law to themselves. They are a law for themselves, even though they do not have the law, since they show that the requirements of the law are written in their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts now accusing, now even defending them. So you've got a whole world of people who are aware of God and aware of His nature and of what's right and wrong. They're aware of that, even though they did not have the law given directly to them, specifically to them. So what we're looking at is a whole spectrum of preparation that God has done with the entire world. And we're going to look at the Acts of the 17th chapter and the altars of the unknown God. We'll look at that in a couple of weeks. And you know, that's just astonishing at the fact that there would be this altar in Athens called the Altar to the Unknown God. And we'll look at the story and the record behind that. Acts 14, 15 through 17. And the reason why I'm reading these is because I've been served notice that these blank spaces where people are out here talking, I've got to either go back there and hold the microphone because it's leaving these big, long vacant spots on the tape and it doesn't make sense. So we're going to try to correct that. Acts 14, 15 through 17. Men, why are you doing this? They were offering sacrifices to Paul. Oh, our time is up. We too are only men like you. We bring you good news, telling you to turn from these worthless things to the living God who made heaven and earth and sea and everything in them. In the past, he let all the nations go their own way, yet he has not left himself without testimony. He has shown kindness by giving to you rain from heaven and crops in their seasons, and provides you with plenty of food, fills your hearts with joy. So he talks about the relationship that God had even to the non-Jewish nations. And then the one in Acts 17 is the record of the unknown God, and we'll notice that in a Sunday or two. I don't mean to talk as much as I have today, but we'll get back to where we won't do that, but I had to lay some foundation. As we look at the Bible account, and while we're looking at the backbone of the Bible, but then there is a whole storehouse of support. If you want to look at, there's a corset around that backbone of the Bible that supports it from virtually every major culture in the world at one time or another, or in one way or another. So that we're a part of something that is not just the concoction of somebody's wild imagination. It's not just the accumulation of unrelated stories and traditions. We're looking at a very coherent revelation that has a specific purpose, that has a golden thread of continuity, and by the grace of God and not due to one single thing that you or I have done, we have been brought into contact with this God who coherently revealed himself to the Jewish nation, and we've been given an opportunity to be a part of his worldwide plan to recapture a runaway people. A runaway earth. And his idea was to get everybody on earth to know who he is so that they could come to know him and worship him and love him and be accepted back home.